Let's turn to Luke chapter 16. Luke 16. Remember, chapter 15 of Luke was dealing with the parables of the seekers. And Luke 16 is going to be loosely connected to that. And as a setting, we want to remember what the context is talking about here. It's going to become important, not so much this week, but next week, it's going to become very important in verse 18 of chapter 16, where it says, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And that's one of those old hammer verses that people use, you know, and misunderstand and take out of context all the time. And the context is going to become important when we get down there. But the context is this, and we've seen it as we've gone through the parables here in Luke. Of course, Luke is the parable book. It has more parables than any other gospel. And the setting is the errors of the Pharisees. That's what Jesus is dealing with here. He's dealing with the errors of the Pharisees. They had all kinds of errors. They were hypocrites, for one. Look at chapter 12, back at chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, under these circumstances, after so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So they were a bunch of hypocrites, and Jesus is using these parables to illustrate their hypocrisy. They were covetous. Look at 12:15. Chapter 12 and verse 15 says, then he said to them, beware, be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even one has an abundance, does his life consist of his possessions. And we'll see that this evening in this evening's parable. Talking about your life does not consist of your possessions. Now, the Pharisees had a different view on that, and we'll look at it again this evening. We've looked at it before, I know, but we'll look at it again. It's also going to talk about the pride of the Pharisees in 14:11. We had that. Chapter 14 and verse 11. Where it says, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And here we are going through the parables, and we're seeing all these errors that the Pharisees were making. And the Pharisees, remember, were the super religious people of Israel. Their concept of God was warped. In chapter 15 and verse 2, it says, both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So their concept of God was a God who would not associate with a sinner, who would not even have anything to do with them. And we noted that they even went to the point of saying that every time a sinner died, God rejoiced because another sinner he didn't have to deal with in this life. So their concept of God was totally warped. Their concept of money was totally warped. Let's look at 19 and 20. Verse 19 says, now there was a rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, joyously living in splendor every day. And a poor man named Lazarus, who was laid at his gate covered with sores. And that's, of course, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus that we'll get to next week, talking about the Pharisees' concept of money, which was, put very simply, the more money you had, the more it proved that God loved you. That was their concept of money. So, as I said before, there's a loose connection between this parable and that of the seeking father. And the seeking parables were in chapter 15. Remember, that whole chapter is devoted to the fact that... Am I boring you, Chan?
No.
Okay.
I'm depressed because okay. I don't have a lot of money, therefore God doesn't love me.
Okay. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Chan is an old buddy of mine, so I...
And that's the way it creeps
in. And this is Wednesday night, so we get a little more relaxed.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, just the correspondence between this parable and the last is that the word squandered that we have here, and we're going to see that the manager is going to squander his master's money. Remember the parable of the prodigal son, or the seeking father, as we called it, because the parable's really about the father, not the son. But that word squandered, diaskorpizo, is exactly the same word that's used for what the son did with his money he got from his father as what the manager is going to do with his boss's funds or his master's funds. So let's look at that now. In chapter 16, and we're going to be looking at 1 through 13. Let's read those. Starting at verse 1, it says, "Now he was also saying to his disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since I'm not strong enough to dig, or my master is taking my management away from me, and I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg? I know what I shall do, so that when I'm removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes.' And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, 'How much do you owe, my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light.'" And that's Jesus' editorial. You know, unbelievers know more about each other than believers do. Verse 9 says, "And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He was faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he was unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." Let's look at the details of that now. It's really not a very difficult parable to understand. The rich man was probably a landowner. We would at least say he owned land. He had an estate because he had a manager to run it for him. So he must have been pretty well off. Now, he had this manager that took care of the business. He was what we call a gentleman farmer. Have you ever heard that term? A gentleman farmer is a farmer who owns lots of land, but he doesn't farm it himself. He has people to do that for him. And that's what this guy would be. what we would call them in today's society. And he had tenants who paid their rent by giving part of the produce to the manager. Now, we have a word for that, too. It's called sharecropping. I would have a place on a piece of land that belonged to somebody else. I would do the work. I'd plant the crops and harvest. And at the end of the harvest, I would pay the owner of the land a percentage of the crop for the privilege of using his land. And that's what the occasion was here. That's what the deal was. This guy had a manager, and the manager was in charge of his sharecroppers. Okay, so he was very well-to-do. Now, the parable assumes that the rich man is honest. There's no dishonesty going on here. There will be some unethical stuff, but not out-and-out dishonesty. The manager now, we'll move over to him, this position was held by a free man. This was not a slave, because to be a manager of a wealthy person's property, you were a free man. That was a free man's job. So it wasn't a slave, it was a free man. So when this man loses his job as manager, he's going to be treated differently than if he were a slave. Look at 16:2. It says, "And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager.'" Look back at chapter 12 and verse 46. What happens when a master comes back and he finds out his slave has been sloughing off? In verse 46, it says, "The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour he does not know, and he cut him to pieces." So there's a little bit different treatment going on here. You don't see this guy saying, "You mismanaged my estate, I'm going to hack you into little bits." He says, "You mismanaged my estate, you're fired. You have 2 weeks' notice." Because he's going to give the manager notice, just like we do today. He's going to say, you've got 2 weeks to get out of here. So what's the problem? The problem, simply this, one of mismanagement. The manager just wasn't any good at his job. He just didn't do his job right. He squandered the master's money. He didn't defraud him. He didn't embezzle anything. He just was not a good manager. So we don't see in the parable that the man's ever arrested. He's not ever arrested. He's let go because of his inefficiency. He loses his job. That's his punishment. The parable here is directed toward the Pharisees who believed, remember what the Pharisees believed? That the acquisition of money was the highest good in life because it proved divine favor. Look back at Deuteronomy 28. We'll look at that again since Chan's here. Deuteronomy 28. And in Deuteronomy 28, verse 11 and 12, this is where they get the idea that being wealthy is proof that God is smiling on you and you are spiritual. Verse 11 says, "The Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the offspring of your body and in the offspring of your beast and in the produce of your ground in the land in which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open for you his good storehouse, the heavens, to give rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow." So nation Israel is to be blessed. So the Pharisees took this to mean, well, if nation Israel is to be blessed, gosh, I'm a Jew. That means that the more money I have, the more God is blessing me. See, they totally misunderstood that. And they applied it to themselves and said that You know, if the more money I have, the more God must love me because he's given me a lot of money. They devoted their lives to the collection of wealth, and they thought that indicated God's approval. That's who Jesus is talking to here. It's who he's dealing with, is these Pharisees. So they made ostentatious displays of their wealth so that everybody could know how spiritual they were and how much God liked them. So they tried to prove to each other that they were God's favorite by showing off their wealth. So the problem in the parable comes down to this. If the Pharisees are wrong about this, and Jesus is going to say that wealth is not the issue. Well, if the Pharisees are wrong, then how can I handle my wealth properly? Is it wrong to be wealthy? No, it's not wrong to be wealthy, but how do I handle my wealth properly? How should it be used properly? And that's what Jesus is going to talk about here. In the solution part, first we find out that after a long period of time, a report of the manager's mismanagement comes to the owner's attention. And we saw that in verse 1. The manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. So he got word that his manager was squandering his possessions. This mismanagement led to the manager's dismissal. So the guy came up to him, says, look, you're no good as a manager. You're fired. You've got 2 weeks' notice. So we have his predicament in verse 3. First, his physical condition makes manual labor an impossibility. Verse 3 says, the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. So his physical condition precluded manual labor. His pride or self-respect made begging impossible. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here because he lost his job. He's too weak to dig. He's too proud to beg. What's he going to do? Well, he comes up with this plan. And really, this is a great plan. This guy is sharp. I don't know how he was such a bad manager, but he apparently had an epiphany here. But he gets another alternative in mind. He has a few days left while he's still working. He got notice given. He begins to call in everybody that owes his master money. And in verse 5 and 6, you see that the first one owed 800 gallons of olive oil. Verse 5 says, he summoned each one of his master's debtors. And he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and quickly write down 50. 800 measures or gallons of olive oil. A large amount, very valuable. So what does he do? Cuts the bill in half. Now, can he do that? Yeah, he's still the manager. I mean, the manager has certain things he can do, and that was his job. It was his job to manage the boss's estate. So he brings in a guy, and he says, you owe 800 gallons of olive oil? I'm going to cut your bill in half today. He cuts the guy's bill in half. Then the second guy comes in, and he owes 1,000 bushels of wheat. So what's this manager do? This guy's great, isn't he? He says, hey, you know, you won the prize today, and I like you better than I like the rest of these sharecroppers. I'm going to cut your bill from 1,000 bushels down to 800. So we got him cutting the bills of the people who owe his master money, which technically he has the right to do because he's still the manager. Now, it's not ethical by any mean, any stretch of the imagination, but technically he has a right to do that. So his plan is to use his authority in this time, the time he has left before he has to leave, his 2 weeks' notice, to gain friends, and these people will provide for him after he loses his job. So that's the plan. And that's a pretty good plan if you stop and think about it. I mean, these guys are going to be grateful as can be. Boy, he cut my bill in half. Now, what the manager did was wrong. There's no doubt. I mean, it was wrong. It was his job to manage his master's goods, not give them away. And in verse 8, he's called the unrighteous manager. It says in verse 8, and his master praised the unrighteous manager. The master praises him. So his boss comes up and said, man, that is a good idea. Where'd you ever come up with that? So the manager praised him. Actually, he was cheating his master out of the money by reducing those debts, right? But the master commended him. Now, notice here, he did not commend him for being dishonest. He didn't commend him for being selfish. What did he commend him for? He commends him for being shrewd. He said, that was a shrewd thing to do. That was a smart thing to do. And that's phronemos. Phronemos means prudent, wise, smart. This is a smart move, business-wise. We have to ask, what did the manager do that was wise and prudent? Well, he used his present opportunities. He had 2 weeks left, right? He used those present opportunities to view the future that he was going to get from them. He used the present opportunities that he had to make opportunities in the future or for his benefit in the future. In other words, he took the long view. He did what he had with what he had now, thinking about the future. Now, a foolish person lives for the present. They don't care about the future. We use this as a basic business principle, don't we? And we invest money for the future. Some of us do. Those of us who have any invest money for the future. That's just a sound business. And that's what he was doing. He was investing the authority that he had at the present for into the future. So what's the point of all this parable? Well, the point is simply this. It's a believer should use his time, his position, and his wealth with a view to the future. Not the temporal future, but the eternal future. In other words, the believer ought to take the long view. Because we're going to be in eternity a lot longer than we're going to be here. So in verse 9 through 13, Christ makes an application of this. And first, he makes an observation in verse 8, the last part, struck me as funny. He says, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. Remember, he's talking to his disciples now. He's teaching his disciples. And he says, you know what? These unbelievers know each other better than you believers do. And they prepare better for their futures, as limited as they may be, speaking temporally, better than you prepare for eternity. You see the idea that he's putting across in this parable? So that's the point of the parable and the observation. And you could say that a believer has a portfolio, has two portfolios. Now, in my case, they're probably 3x5 cards, not portfolio size, but they have two of them. One of them is for our future here on earth. and what we do here, what we spend here, how we spend our time here, our wealth, our position, everything we have. That's our portfolio for eternity. Then we have a portfolio of the stocks and bonds and investments that we have for our retirement. And Jesus is saying, which one should have the priority? That's all this parable is saying. Where should you put your priority? On your portfolio for eternity or on your portfolio for your old age? There's nothing wrong with saving for your old age. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with being wealthy. There's nothing wrong with that. But Jesus is saying, look, just think about what is more important, eternity or this world. So where are you going to spend your time? Now, he talks about the wealth of unrighteousness here, and that's kind of a difficult phrase. In verse 9, he says, and I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness. And all he's talking about here is the wealth. Wealth refers to anything, like I went through before. It can be your position. It can be your money that you have, holdings, property, anything you have. Authority is a part of our wealth that we have, and we can spend our authority for temporal things or for eternal things. And the wealth of unrighteousness, it's called that because of the means by which it was obtained, the temporal wealth. So what he's getting at, what Jesus is trying to tell his disciples, and remember the parables he's giving here are to his disciples. They're not to the masses in general. He's saying that you guys, you need to use your material possessions with a different motivation. Your motivation is to be the good of others and eternal benefit to yourself. You used to think of it as, I've got a dime in my pocket, I'm going to go buy candy with it. You know, and every time you get a little money, you go buy candy with it. Obviously, I've done that a few times. But that's the idea. He's saying, don't do that. Think about it. You want to invest that in now or eternity? There's a choice. So he comes up to the principle in verse 10. There's a couple principles, or several principles involved here. The principle in verse 10 is that capability for handling great matters may be determined by handling small matters. In verse 10, he was faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Another principle, money should be viewed as something God entrusts us with, kind of like a loan or a trust. In verse 11, he says, therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, that's the wealth that God loaned you, who will entrust you with the true riches you have? And another principle in verse 13 is that it is psychologically impossible to serve those two masters at the same time. Verse 13 says, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Now, we need to look at his idiomatic expression here. And in verse 13, we have what we call a Hebraism. And Paul is using a Hebrew idiom of love and hate. And we find that, remember we looked at it before in Romans chapter 9. We looked at it in the Old Testament when we were studying the book of Genesis. Love and hate to a Jew was a matter of the will. not the emotions. So when he says you're going to love one and hate the other, he says that is to say you're going to set your will against one and not the other. Just like Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Did God hate Esau in the terms of an emotional hatred? No. It simply means that he, by his divine will, chose Jacob and not Esau. That was their idiomatic way of saying he chose one and not the other. And that's what Jesus is saying. You guys got a choice to make. He's not going to say, this is an emotional thing. You're going to have to hate money. And, you can try to work up a good hate for money. I never have been able to. That's not what he means here. He says you're going to have to make a decision. It's a matter of the will. You cannot be wholeheartedly devoted to these two masters. So the would-be disciples, and that's who he's talking to here, remember, he's taking the disciples aside, and he's telling these would-be disciples, you got to decide whether Christ is going to be your master or money. So we can learn some lessons from this parable, and the first is that we should examine our zeal for the temporal, be it money or anything else, next to our zeal for the eternal. And that's what it boils down to. It's what this whole thing boils down to. It's really quite simple. It's, do we spend our time on temporal things or eternal things? You know, we come to church on Wednesday night and Sunday morning, and all the rest of our time is spent elsewhere. What do we do with that time? That's what he's saying. Now, for a disciple. And he's talking to his disciples here, remember. The business world of the unbeliever provides zeal for the temporal, and he says that. These guys are, they know their kind better than you guys know your own kind. So they have a zeal for their money. Why don't you have a zeal like that for the eternal things? So the life of the believer, in the life of the believer, this would be compared to our zeal for eternal things, eternal values. You look at people and you see their zeal for wealth, and then you look at believers and look at their zeal for the eternal. He's just saying, if you want to be a disciple of Christ, then that's what you need to do. Faithfulness in a very little thing sums up everything pertaining to earthly life. Faithfulness in a little thing, that's our earthly life. Much is the sum of eternal values. So when he says, he who is faithful in a very little thing, that's everything we do for our temporal lives, is faithful also in much. So be faithful to eternal values. Like I said, this parable isn't all that hard to understand. He's just saying to his disciples, you guys have a choice to make. And if you want to be my disciple, then you're going to have to place eternal values above temporal values. Not talking about being a believer. He's talking about being a disciple. His disciples wanted to follow him, and he's telling them, remember, if you want to follow me, it's tough. There's going to be difficulty, and this is one of them. Because if you follow the Pharisees, you know, everything you've learned since you were a kid for these people was that wealth was indicative of God's favor. And now you're going to have to unlearn that, and you're going to have to trust me. And that's what Jesus is saying. Not me. Don't trust me. You'd be crazy if you trusted me. But Jesus is saying, trust me. The next parable, you'll notice in the context, starts at verse 19. which leaves 14 through 18 as a little interchange in between two parables. And we have to understand where this fits in order to understand verse 18, because verse 18 is, as I said before, one of those hammer verses. It comes into the context here. And what's the context he's talking about? He's talking about what the Pharisees believe over true spirituality. And he's putting those two side by side, contrasting, comparing them. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he makes a statement about divorce. If you read this in its context, it seems totally out of place. Why on earth would he bring that up here? Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery? Why? That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about Pharisees versus spirituality. And if you want to find out what it means, come back next week. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for this parable that you've given us, teaching us that if we were to be disciples of you, or if we are to be disciples of you, we have a decision to make. That decision being, where are we going to spend our resources? Our resources of any kind that we have. Are we going to stop and think about whether these are being used in a way that will bring eternal value or simply temporal value? Father, we pray that we can make wise decisions and choices based on your word. In Christ's name, amen.